right. Thanks to Mark for starting us off with an introduction of this new study. God does great things in the Old Testament is what we're looking at this quarter. And we had polled everyone and came up with the top 10 results. And surprise, creation was the number one. Almost, Mark didn't tell me it was unanimous, but based upon the data that he put out, it was obvious that it was unanimous. I remember shortly after we said, hey, write down the 10 greatest acts of the Old Testament, Lindsay stopped me in back and said that she was just going to write creation across all 10, and we laughed, and I thought I had the same reaction. So we're going to talk this morning about the creation as it relates to heaven and earth, basically Genesis 1. And then next Sunday, we'll talk about man, the creation of Adam and Eve and man, and get into that, basically Genesis 2 aspect of it. I don't know about you, but when I turn to Genesis 1 and start studying the first few chapters of Genesis, my study over the years has been fairly consistent in one of two areas. The first aspect of the study would be to dig into each one of the details of the day, and just it's so fascinating to look at day one, day two, day three, day four, day five, day six, and look at how it all interrelates and the interesting aspects of it all. And so you end up digging into the text and just trying to understand the details of the text. That's the first way. Hopefully, we've left that to you guys. That's basically question one in the book. What are some of the things God has done? So hopefully you've looked, read through that multiple times. We won't take the time to read the 31 verses of Genesis 1 this morning just for time's sake, but hopefully you've done that and you've looked at the details. The second way I usually study this is more of an apologetic approach. Well, what does this say about how God created and how that can be refuting atheism or refuting evolution or theistic evolution or certain theories and teachings that come out of this that I don't agree with? And so I go to the text and try to study it to look at it in terms of an apologetic approach. God revealed this. False religions or false teachers say this, and then try to figure out how we might, from an apologetic standpoint, refute what they have to say. That's the way I've usually studied this. So we've asked you to study it differently, and Mark, thank you for setting the table for this. We want to look at this text just in terms of what does this tell us about God. So we'll look at this, and we'll say, yes, day one, light, dark, and this is obviously a summary because it's so interesting and complicated. Day two, sky, sea. Day three, land, plants. Day four, sun, moon, and stars. Day five, fish and birds. Day six, animals and humans, and then rest. Let's move beyond that and look more in terms of what does this tell us about God? What do we learn about God? It's basically question three, the reflection question. What do I learn about him? On Wednesday night, we're going to get into some of the implications, and we'll come back to question two on your sheet, which is what some of these, how does it impact me? What is it that amazes me? But so let's begin this morning and just say, what are some of the things that I learn about God when I read Genesis 1. So I've got a list. We'll move through them. It's probably the same list that you have or would have if you had really just tried to focus in on it. But what I want to do is introduce a topic and then chime in. Let me know your thoughts on it. Maybe you'd say it differently or use a different word. The first word that attribute, and this is a word that I'm not sure I was all that familiar with. It's kind of one of those words that seems to be used more recently in articles and books that I've read about the topic. It talks about God and transcendence. Transcendence. So that's not a word we use very much, but it's a word that's kind of one of those hot words that's being used now about God. He is transcendent. And it just simply means that he's outside of space or time. Well, how, when you go straight to the text and it says, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, that's in and of itself speaking, not even implying, speaking of transcendency. He's outside of his creation. The creator creates, he is not his creation, he's outside of his creation. It's one of those things, and I fully understand what, Mark, you were saying when you're like, you feel inadequate to stand up here and try to explain what the transcendency of God is. Well, let's give it a whirl. There's a clear distinction between the creator and the creation, and that's obvious, but it's not so obvious because there are a lot of false religions that will say intermix the creator and the creation. Pantheism, if you're familiar with that type of religion, that it's this false religion that or false idea that God is everywhere and God is in everything, and so we only need to look inside of ourselves potentially. If you've seen movies, Avatar, you know, it's this idea that God is a part of creation. And when you look at other religions, even ancient Eastern religions, their idea was that God was, their gods, little g, was a part of the creation. You know, Egyptians would have the sun as a god, Ra, and on and on and on. So there would be an intermingling of this concept of the creator and the creation. Not so in Genesis 1. And it's just important and obvious to point that out as we begin. I think we start this with our little kids. I was thinking, how do you teach transcendence to a child? Got that under control, Jake? What do you say to them? That's great. That's great. Yeah, you have to try to someone that is not familiar and grows up with it, you have to just try to create some perspective, some visualization. If you grew up in the early 2000s or you had kids in the early 2000s, we allowed Bob the Tomato, I think, and Junior Asparagus to help kids understand the transcendency of God. You remember that song? God is bigger than the boogeyman. He's bigger than Godzilla and the monsters on TV. God is bigger than the boogeyman, and he's watching out for you and me. Are you frightened? No, not really. Are you scared? Not a bit. I mean, that's what we try to get our kids to understand, the transcendency of God. Now, it's more complicated than God is bigger than whatever fears we might have, but that's the start of understanding the transcendency of God. How else might you say it? Bigger? Yeah. Okay. He's everywhere. Yeah. Yeah. Limitless. Everywhere. All powerful. I mean, you try to use words. I mean, one thing we might say is he's independent. He's not dependent on anything that he has created. He is limitless. He is separate. He is, in a sense, there's the doctrine of hiddenness. I don't know if you've ever, as you study this, you kind of start running a bunch of rabbits And if we have time at the end of class, we'll maybe get back into it. But God is hidden in a sense because he is not something or someone, a being that we can fully comprehend. And so he becomes independent from his creation. We might say he's uncaused. So you have the caused creation, Genesis 1. You have the uncaused, because when we get dropped into the narrative, in the beginning, God, there is that eternal uncaused assumption that is placed upon us. So when we first read this, if we were reading it for the first time, we might say, well, where did he come from? What's the backstory to Elohim, the mighty one, the powerful one, Elohim, the plural? And the answer is there is no backstory. He is. I am. And we don't learn that until later on in the scriptures, but when we begin in Genesis 1 and just say, what do we learn from it? You start to see some of these things. Turn over to Acts 17, just the New Testament. We've looked at this, you're familiar with this, but I want to read it. Acts 17, 24 and 25. The God who made the world and all things in it, since he is Lord of heaven and earth, does not dwell in temples made with hands, neither is he served by human hands, as though he needed anything, since he himself gives to all life and breath and all things. Paul, to these philosophers in Athens, is saying God is transcendent. He's independent. He doesn't need anything, and he's not served by humans or needs humans for any sense. Now, turn back. Oh, any other thoughts on that? Without want, lack, or need. Did God need man for some particular reason? Absolutely not. You know, his graciousness created us, but he did not need us. Any other thoughts there on transcendency? Look in Jeremiah 23. So there's an interesting question as you think about how big God is, how limitless he is. That could cause us in our humanness to do what? Potentially. Well, give up, yeah, or be so in awe, so distant, so feeling like he is so above, so beyond, that it puts us in a little bit of an awe, but kind of puts us distant from him. And that's exactly what Jeremiah gets at with an interesting question in Jeremiah 23:23. It says, God is declaring, am I a God who is near and not a God who is far off? So the far off would be transcendency. What's the answer to the question? What are you, God? Are you near or are you far? Well, transcendency would say you're far. But is that right? What's the answer? Both. So what is the attribute of God that would suggest he's near? Here's another word we probably don't use very much, but when you get into theology, it's immanence. Immanence, not imminent. Imminent means, you know, an imminent threat. It's going to happen soon. It is about to occur. And we think of immense as large. Those are different words. I had to look those up. So imminence, it means it's not the opposite of transcendent, but it seems to be in conflict, because is he far or is he near? Because now we have, and this is where it gets mind-blowing, yet it's essential for us to understand that not only is he transcendent, but he's also immanent in the sense that he's near. So this is a God who is independent from creation, but then steps into creation. He's present within the time and space. It doesn't limit him. but he comes to it and is a part of it. It's not some abstract force. A deist would say that God created the heavens and the earth and then stepped back and said, okay, let's watch this and see what happens. That's what a deist says. That's where Thomas Jefferson got it all wrong. That's not a watchmaker making a watch and then winding it up and letting it go. That might even be, you know, it's a part of theistic evolution. Just created it and then just watched it go. That's not God, because the Bible says that he's, this immanence is an indwelling. That's what the word means. Inherit, indwelling. He becomes a part of the creation in the sense that he steps into it and acts within it. He's present. Look in Colossians 1 and verse 17. In the New Testament, we'll speak to it as it starts talking about how God is a part of the creation that he has so wonderfully made. And he is before all things, and in him all things hold together. Immanence. God is independent of his creation, but he's controlling it. He is guiding it. He is governing it. And that's an amazing thought. And so when we get to that point, you say, well, what's evidence of that? His word then becomes the evidence of his participation. And it, we could turn to a number of passages, but the whole theme of the idea that God is with us, God becomes a manifestation to humans of his participation. It started with the children of Israel, with things like clouds and pillars of fire and descending on the temple, and then it moved to the New Testament with Emmanuel, Jesus, God with us. This whole idea of immanence is God being with us throughout his creation process. Any thoughts on that? Yeah. Right. So, yeah, there's this whole idea. He creates it, then he sustains it, and then his providential activity rules over it. We're going to talk a little bit more about that on Wednesday. I'll get to the question that I want you to kind of think of, but it's this idea of controlling his creation. That's immanence. Other thoughts? Yeah, Bailey points out when people try to come up with alternative gods, it's interesting because typically what they do is they look at the scene and then create a god out of it. And whether it's weather or sun, like we said earlier, attributes, that's what man comes up with because the hiddenness of God is so incomprehensible that we can't come up with any alternative that would even come close to the reality of a transcendent, immanent God. It is fascinating. Other thoughts? Yes? Yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking. So then the Bible showcases the fact that he is omnipresent. He is within the story. We could look at Psalms 139 or go back to Acts 17 again. And it's obvious that he is a part of the theodrama that we are learning about as we read this. It is God's love story, and he's definitely a part of it and controlling it. Another way... another thought that I had is only. When you think about the transcendency and the immanence of God, it comes across, you know, nothing made everything. It's absurd. Matter is eternal. It's absurd. There's nothing about anything that we experience on earth that would make us think that matter is eternal. The gods, in the beginning, the gods made? No. The writer, God, through his revelation, is very clear that he is the only God, and you get that straight out of the gate. The other thing that I think about at this point is we talked about Elohim, and we've talked about in times past the plural nature of Elohim, but you see in 26, let us make man in our own image, and so we shouldn't go forward without recognizing that God, the Son, the Spirit that's already been mentioned, is a part of this creation, and it is a theme that runs through the entire theodrama. You can look in a number of passages where it talks about God creating, and then you can look in passages, John 1, where it talks about the Word, Jesus, the Son creating, and then you can see in the Spirit's activity in a couple of different passages. So this is the entire Trinity is a part of this creative process. Easy to understand? Easy to explain to kids? No, the Godhead is a difficult concept even for all of us who have been struggling with it for years to explain, but it is fact, and it is a great thing that when we think about it and wrap our minds to the extent we can about a plurality of God. One of the things that becomes obvious to me as we read the text, this doesn't come from an it. Genesis 1 isn't a creative process from an it. Obviously, God is living, and he is breathing life. We'll really see that in the second chapter as he comes to man and breathes the breath. But he's breathing life into animals. He's breathing his life into a lifeless state and creating this incredible living universe, and it's an amazing thing. Any thoughts on that? Yeah. And that's a great point, John, is because when we look at this in context, the point that I think that he's making is that the God that delivered you, us, let me tell you about him. Let's go back and begin the story of this God that delivered. And so you get that context. And yeah, at that point, there's a lot of competing interests. Let's talk about the one true living God. And so you get that. And at that point, he's personal. He's been interacting with his nation. And let's not miss that point as we come through here. Even in the first couple of chapters, particularly in chapter 2, we'll talk about it more next week, but this is a relational God. This is not some God that's going to, again, set back and be inactive, as Tim has mentioned. He is very personal, and that's what he desires. We mentioned powerful, everything from nothing. I mean, is that the way we would do it? Let's say we're going to create something as amazing as this. Boy, it would be more than just a fiat speaking it If you're thinking like I am, man, I would. I was thinking that Disney movie Fantasia. You know, this is going to be lots of things are swirling around. This is going to be amazing, and it's going to be a big, huge production. And what's interesting is, God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. I just take that for what it is, fiat speaking light into existence. And then you get this rhythm. God said, and it happened, and it was good. God said, and it happened, and it was good. Would we use the scheme of command, one author wrote, the scheme of command is simply make something this amazing. That's what God used. And it is simply amazing that the instrument of action that he used was the Word. And then you see that theme of the Word moving through the entire Bible, coming to the point in which we start to really relate to the Word in John 1, as we see the mighty and powerful Elohim just simply speaking all of this into existence. That is mind-blowing. Thoughts on that? It's hard to know what to say, yeah. Yeah.
There is order to what God has done. From the creation, to the Bible, to the world that he has made, there is an order. And it is not chaos.
Yeah, that's a great point. Order. Add that to our list. Order. And it's abundant. And you say, we've all been in discussions with someone who doesn't believe in God, and you say, the alternative? You think this is, you don't have enough evidence. The alternative is so much more absurd that at some point there's going to be faith involved, or you're just going to cling to absurdities. So that's a great point. How about this one? I mean, God is beautiful. How do we know that? And I say, we know that. Just look around and no one that isn't beautiful, glory, maybe a better word. He's glorious, because we just look around and we see glorious things. And so that bespeaks the fact that the Creator is beautiful. There's a number, I mean, I think that's what Psalms 19 is saying. Man, look around, look in the heavens, what do you see? You see glory. It bespeaks glory. And the psalmist was doing that, we do it, we should do it as often as we can, is just to get out in creation and realize that the Creator is beautiful. He is glorious. He is orderly. And we can't talk about it enough. I mean, what was the most beautiful place you've ever been in your life? Where is it? Yosemite. Grand Tetons. Somebody's going there in a few months. Where else? Yeah. It's it's screaming out to us. This morning was screaming out to us. God, in his ceaseless display of majestic splendor, wherever you're at, Tetons or Yosemite or in your backyard watching birds fly around, it's just screaming, there is a God when we're paying attention. I mean, it's what happens when we see. The psalmist says, I look up into the heavens and I see God's glory. I understand that. We're wired to look around and be amazed at what we see and reflect on the Creator. That's how we're wired. That's why the ancients are always trying to find, if they didn't believe in Elohim, they were trying to figure out something else to affix their worship, because we're going to worship. We're wired that way. And so we get into majestic settings and we feel something. What do we feel? We feel the presence of sacredness through the creation. Bennett. Bennett points out, we experience transcendency in conjunction with immanence all the time. We do it in nature, but then we meet people and we create that bond, and we start to draw close after being far apart, and we start experiencing the godly process of transcendence and immanence in our own lives, and we experience it, and it feels right. It starts to cause wonder. And then it ultimately leads to worship. That's how we're wired, when we're thinking properly amongst creation. And so it's an amazing thing. I was like, we were down in Dallas during the middle of the week, and we were in the downtown Dallas. Have you been down there lately? My goodness, there are buildings everywhere, and there are people everywhere, and there are cars everywhere. And I was starting to get a little claustrophobic. And, you know, I've lived my whole life in Kansas City, and we're getting a little crowded, but let me tell you what, it isn't anything like that. Some of you are nodding like the Jones' daughter's living down there now. If you go visit them, you're like, this is a concrete jungle. You feel like you're in Chicago or L.A. or New York down there. And then we drove out and went out to White Rock Lake, and suddenly I just completely felt different when I got out into the setting of a beautiful lake with geese flying around. And I sat there and I thought, that's the way you're supposed to feel, I think. Not criticizing anybody that lives in the city, because I get it, but when you get out amongst the creation, you feel different. There is a sense that comes over you that I think is God-driven. Yes? We're without excuse. Yeah. It's where chaos becomes calm. Yes. Yeah, as you say that, Tim, it strikes me that God's description of what he'd done was good. Well, that seems like a very ordinary word, doesn't it? Good. It's good. Not great. It's good. No, what he's saying is, I think that ties into this holiness. God is pure. God is holy. And he created something that is good. It is as designed. It is orderly. It is good. And only sin would mar this incredible goodness, and man jumped right into the middle of that. The creation was seeking purity and righteousness, and man marred it all with sin, but then God, in the theodrama, it plays out, God provided his provision to lift the curse and bring the purity back to the creation that he had made, and ultimately the purity of it all will be restored at the end time. So that's kind of an interesting thread, but we see the holiness. I can't even begin to talk about it, so we'll just move on. He's gracious. I love that about our God. He's gracious. We'll start to see. He's provided for everything. It's so orderly. Even the little insects are provided for. Isn't that amazing? And God is so gracious. And we can look at that in the animal world, and then we can say, well, how much more gracious would he be when he says, let us make man out of our own image? How much more gracious will he be to us? We'll talk about that a little bit more. He's a sovereign king. We see that coming through in how he is the one who is orchestrating. He is the maestro of chapter 1. He is the sovereign king. He is in control. We want to spend the rest of our time now talking about designer, and then we'll hit on this as we begin Wednesday night. God is the designer. He's like a craftsman. God is said in a number of different creation passages. We won't go to them all, or any of them at this point. But there are a number of psalms. It's interesting that Isaiah, for 40 through 55, just keeps coming back to the creation, to talk about it in a number of different ways and imagery. And so we have all these passages. Job, that great poetic dissertation at the end of Job, where God is questioning Job about his actions. And so we see a number of creation passages, but it's interesting that God is said to have formed, shaped, made. And so when we see those words being used, I'll just throw these up here. I just found it interesting that, and these are Hebrew words that all speak to craftsmanship and building and relate. There's specific creation passages that say that God built the creation. Bana says Yasar. He formed it or he shaped it. It's referenced that he grounded it. Coven is to erect, and it's talking about another building term. God erected all of this. That's a tent term. That's used to reference how God, in tent fashion, he stretched it all out like you were putting up a tent. And so we see this is a little bit different one. This is to make with your hands or your fingers, and God is described as doing that with creation, asa. But it's interesting that all these building terms are not the terms that are used in Genesis 1:1. There's one word that doesn't really fit this building, and that's bara. The Hebrew word bara, it's scholars have struggled to try to figure out exactly how to translate it, exactly what it is. It's used a number of different, this is not the only time it's used. It's used throughout scriptures, but it's a very unique word in the Hebrew language that means to produce something new. In other words, this is not something humans do. The first six of those are all can be described as humans building, erecting tents and things, but this one word is only used as it relates to God. And when it says, in the beginning, God created, God bara the heavens and the earth. It's interesting that this is an unheard of act that only could be performed by someone as transcendent and as imminent as God himself. And so we have that. All right, second bell. Here's what we're going to do on Wednesday. We're going to come back and talk a little bit more about the design aspect of God, but I want you to answer these two questions. That's hard to read. What aspect of creation is most impactful for you in terms of appreciating God's design of all things? So if someone came up to you and said, you know, just give me, what is it about all that is around us, creation, that really speaks to you about God and His design? What would you tell them? How would you answer that? How would you, if God is hidden in a sense, God also wants us to reveal Him to other people. So how would you answer that? And the second one was, is how is the realization that God is in control helping you in your daily walk? If God is in control of all this, and I think Tim accurately said that, He's active. He is participating in this. Sometimes this really wrecks people's faith because they think God is in control, but something bad is happening to me. How do I reconcile that? So we'll talk about that a little on Wednesday night as well. Okay. Thanks for your comments.